Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, it's Don Jr. week at the White House. actually, there's a lot going on. I mean, there's actually a lot going on.
We've got
a big healthcare battle still going on Capitol Hill. We've got a new FBI director facing his, or nominee, facing his confirmation hearing. We've got the president embarking on his third foreign trip, this one to France for Bastille Day. But I got to tell you, the Don Jr. story has kind of dominated everything else. And the other thing that is striking as your White House correspondent is the fact that I go to the White House every day. I have not caught a glimpse of either the president of the United States or his press secretary all week.
Do we know that they're in the building? Do we have confirmation of that? Is that established?
You know, there are a couple little telltale signs. There is a Marine guard, that stands watch at the West Wing whenever the president is in the Oval Office. I have seen at times the Marine guard there, so I assume I know that that means the president's in the Oval Office. I have talked to a colleague who caught a glimpse of Sean Spicer. I've heard what sounded like Spicer's voice behind his door. I think he was in a meeting. So I think they're there. But let me tell you, this, and I know we sound a little bit like a broken record here, but this is not ordinary. to see three straight days now, weekdays, 4 days if you want to include the Sunday, where there has not been a single public event on the president's schedule. That is unusual for any president. It is particularly unusual for this president, who has taken such pride in the fact that he is so busy, he's high energy, he's doing lots of events, his schedule is, I mean, in this case, we haven't seen him.
Could it be that he doesn't have anything good to talk about? I mean, the problem with his son in this, and the what makes this a major moment, for people that have been following every twist and turn of the Russia investigation, what made this a major marking point is that it blew away a year's worth of explanations and denials and equivocations and what have turned out to be half-truths and misstatements along the way. Now we know, because it's there in unbelievable black and white in this email, we know that the president's own son sought information that would have been colluding with what he thought was a Russian government agent. I mean,
yeah,
that's undeniable.
I would put it a little differently. I don't dispute what you said, but I think the way I would put it is, we know as an absolute fact, indisputable fact, that he was told that the Russian government wanted to help his father's presidential campaign and hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign. And we know that when he was told that, he was willing, in fact, eager to accept that help.
He loved it.
Indisputable facts. Now, yeah, we don't know if this Russian lawyer that he met with actually provided anything of significance. We don't know if anything that she had to offer was related at all to the hack of the DNC or the hack of Podesta's emails. We don't know. Those are all unknowables. We do know that there are denials on both sides. We know that Don Jr. denies that, you know, anything, he got anything, and we know the lawyer denies that she had anything whatsoever about Hillary Clinton. But a very damning set of facts, primarily for what it shows that he was willing to do.
That's right. And for all the talk of there were no meetings with the Russians and there was no collusion, no attempt to collusion, no attempt to having contact, all of that gone. And it was such a big meeting, in fact, that Paul Manafort, as the campaign chairman, was there, as was Jared Kushner. Have you seen Jared at the White House this week? Because he's still a White House aide. He's the only person in that room that actually works in the government right now. He took the meeting. He hasn't really made himself evident either.
Yeah, you know, and he's usually a little more behind the scenes.
Sure.
It is a little different for me when we don't see the president himself or his press secretary. So I know we're going to have a conversation coming up with Senator Richard Durbin, obviously the number two Democrat in the Senate. It's kind of particular a point of view on this, and of course on the healthcare battle. But I want to go through. I want to kind of establish a bit of what's been going on, and we've got some sound clips that our team has put together to kind of give us where we are. And let's start with Don Jr. himself. He had the interview with Sean Hannity. By the way, when was the last time the president of the United States did an interview that was not on Fox?
I think you have to go back. You have to go back to Lester Holt.
The Lester Holt interview.
Yeah.
Which was a long time ago.
It's a while ago.
But he is about to do an interview that is not on Fox. This is also very interesting. So he is branching out. The president's going to go out and give an interview that is not on Fox.
Yeah.
Who's that with again?
Well, let's think. Who do you think you want it to? Maybe Pat Robertson?
It's with Pat Robertson.
Yeah, you go to the base, right? Yes. You go to the base when you're in doubt. But
okay, so that was a diversion. So let's go to the interview, Sean Hannity on Fox News, Donald Trump Jr. And first of all, I sensed, and this is the first clip that they put out of the interview, I thought I heard almost a little bit of contrition from Donald Trump Jr. Listen.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press.
Okay. Maybe I'm reading a little bit too much in, but he did say, in retrospect, I would have done things a little differently.
In 2 years of President Trump campaigning and now as president, has he ever said, in retrospect, I would have done something differently? Ever? Even once? Long pause? Radio silence?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and research.
I don't think
that.
He has.
I don't want to. Let's then listen to what else he said, though, in this interview with Sean Hannity.
For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out. But really, it went nowhere, and it was apparent that that wasn't what the meeting was actually about.
Yeah, so, and he goes on to say, like, he gets an email, and he responds. What else is he going to do? I mean, there's clearly not any real regret there.
No, and I think giving the interview to Hannity is partly a sign that he wanted to give one big interview to try to clear the air on this. But it puts his White House, including his father, it was the White House and his dad, in a very tough spot. Because they're on the record as often as they've been, and it just takes away that veneer of deniability that they had. Even if you didn't believe them, they could at least say it. That's no longer there because of what's down in the paper of these emails that Donald Trump Jr. was forced to disclose this week.
And the president, I know he's very loyal to his family, obviously. And we know how important Don Jr. is to his business operation. We know how important Don Jr. was to the campaign. And frankly, I remember back at the Republican convention in Cleveland, he had probably had one of the best speeches in the entire convention.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he hasn't exactly run to the defense of his son here for a while until we got a tweet this morning. The only thing we had from the president himself came through his deputy press secretary in a briefing where they did not allow television cameras. And this was the one very short line from the deputy press secretary.
My son is a high quality person, and I applaud his transparency. And beyond that, I'm going to have to refer everything on this matter to John Jr.'s counsel and outside counsel, and won't have anything else to add beyond that today.
Now, just to clarify, she was not talking. That was Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She was not talking about her son. She was reading a statement from the president.
I'm sure she thinks highly of her children as well. High-quality individual.
High-quality individual.
Yeah.
Which he called Pence, to be fair.
Oh, all right. There you go.
So he's called. He's used that, you know, high-quality. But that was it. But then he did tweet that he was, you know, proud of his son's honesty. And
that he's innocent.
And he's fully innocent.
That he's fully innocent, which, you know, might be interesting as well as the special counsel digs in on this and is interested in that meeting, that the president of the United States is now on the record there. But I agree. It's a lukewarm defense from not just the president, but the whole White House apparatus. They have not been rallying behind Don Jr. And even the president's lawyer seems to be distancing himself or distancing the president's a little bit, saying that he didn't know about it. Even Vice President Pence, whose statement made clear that he's not that interested in rehashing things that happened before he joined the campaign. That was really stunning as well. So that's another indication of why this is different than the other Russia stories.
Yeah, and I've, you know, going to the White House every day this week, first of all, you see the assembled pool reporters. Those are the ones that get called in when the president does a bill signing or something in the Oval Office, or when we come in to see the president doing his job. I mean, they're just lying around waiting to get called in. No, the phone's not ringing, you know. So I've been asking people on the White House staff, what is happening? What's going on? What is the president doing?
All day long.
I did look, you know, you have to understand, you know this, Rick, because you've spent time over there, but the White House, the West Wing, very small.
Right.
And we in that briefing room are about 20, 25 paces from the door to the Oval Office. You're in kind of close proximity. We're not allowed to go knock on the Oval Office, but sometimes when we go up to see the press secretary or the communications director, there is no communications director right now, but right. When there is one, when we go up into that part of the West Wing, there's a door that leads to a short hallway, which leads to the front door of the Oval Office. It's all very short. We're talking about like a short screen pass away.
Yeah.
And I looked up there yesterday, and I just saw a Secret Service agent standing in front of the main door into the Oval Office from that hallway, just standing, almost like he was. Usually, you see a Secret Service agent kind of sitting next to the door when it's closed, standing there, almost as if I swear I got the sense like the president said, "Make sure nobody comes in here." I hear he's been angry. I hear the president has been extremely frustrated. He's been fuming, taking it out on aides. His legal team was over there yesterday, Tuesday. I heard they heard quite an earful from him. Not sure exactly what the nature of his complaint is, other than the extreme frustration that he has that the Russia story does not go away.
Yeah, and it has been made worse now by his own son. So it's one of the people that you really can't put that much distance between yourself and.
And my sense is he has not lashed out at his son in this, although I mean, who knows?
You've seen this flip before. I mean, you go back through the campaign, and there were different power centers inside of Trump Tower and inside of that campaign that the sons were in their own bucket. And there were different campaign groups that were maneuvering around that. And it continues right now to know that you've got the adult sons who are outside the White House handling the business interests, but creating this major, major distraction and putting the credibility of all these officials on the line.
And our colleague over at the New York Times, Maggie Haberman, and her piece with some of the other reporters over there, talked about reported that the statement that came out on Saturday from Don Jr., the one that now looks really bad.
Yeah.
The one where this is all about adoption, you know, the statement that now looks at charitably, you know,
right.
Grossly incomplete, was drafted on Air Force One by the president and his aides. She didn't specify which aides, but all done without the involvement of the president's legal team, Mark Kasowitz and his team of lawyers. So we know that Jay Sekulow on Good Morning America denied that, said that was not true. But we also know that he might not know because by Maggie's reporting, he wasn't part of it.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this, it's consistent with what I've heard. That they were the legal team was completely out of the loop on this.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, and it's forced the White House to recalibrate even what it's saying about potential collusion. I mean, you're hearing now parsing from the podium. You're hearing parsing to a new level of trying to deny something that right now has become obvious. They were not fully honest at really any stage of this.
Okay, so I want to get to that. You're referring to what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said at her one of her again. Cameras banned briefings. But before we get to that, we had the FBI nominee Christopher Wray, nominated to replace Comey, James Comey.
Heard of him?
You remember him? Had his confirmation hearing up Senate, and this was an interesting. You know, these hearings are interesting. But the guy that I always love to watch is Lindsey Graham. Because Lindsey Graham's an old country lawyer from South Carolina, and he started out by asking Ray if he was, you know, if he would be concerned about the Ukrainian government trying to help out the Clinton campaign, because this is something that's been brought up by the White House, and they quickly dispatched with that. But then he had some interesting questions to Ray about Don Jr. Take a listen.
Let me ask you this. If I got a call from somebody saying the Russian government wants to help Lindsey Graham get reelected, they've got dirt on Lindsey Graham's opponent, should I take that meeting?
Well, Senator, I would think you'd want to consult with some good legal advisors before you did that.
So the answer is, should I call the FBI?
I think it would be wise to let the FBI know.
You're going to be the director of the FBI, pal. So here's what I want you to tell every politician. If you get a call from somebody suggesting that a foreign government wants to help you by disparaging your opponent, tell us all to call the FBI.
To the members of this committee, any threat or effort to interfere with our elections from any nation state or any non-state actor is the kind of thing the FBI would want to know.
All right. So I'll take that we should call you, and that's a great answer.
So, Rick, you were still, you were like in first or second grade, I think. But I'm old enough to remember when Lindsey Graham was a freshman member of the House, the second most junior member of the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment hearings, and then appointed, to be one of the managers that argued the case in the Senate. And he's still got it. Back then, he was trying to remove Bill Clinton from office. He seems amped up about this.
Of course, and that's the thing.
He's a Republican. You remember? I know he's Lindsey Graham.
I do remember. I also remember that his phone ended up getting destroyed because Donald Trump gave out his phone number publicly.
Right.
So they have that history.
And as Trump would remind us, he got 0% in the primaries. Was that
about
what he said?
That? Yeah, about roughly. That, including in South Carolina, where they even dropped out before that. But the point here is that this does not make anyone feel good about defending President Trump. I don't know how you look at this and say, well, there's nothing to see here. And I think Lindsey Graham broke it down in a very simple way. And now we have the incoming, we presume, director of the FBI, pending confirmation, saying that Donald Trump Jr. didn't act right here. And that's important, I think, for his own independence. It's also important just for laying down this marker about what is appropriate conduct.
Okay, I'm going to give you what is potentially the most charitable way to look at this and see what you think.
Okay,
Rick.
Go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this guy, Rob Goldstone, who,
of a character.
I mean, come on. So this guy, Rob Goldstone, kind of a quirky, eccentric promoter who's got a Russian rock star as his client. He wants to get his friend, this Russian lawyer, into meet with the Trump folks. So he exaggerates. He says, oh, she's got great stuff. This is going to be amazing. She's really tied in with the, with the Russian government, and they've got all this amazing stuff on Hillary. It's going to... And Don Jr., being inexperienced in the ways of politics, says, yeah, sure, I'd love to hear whatever you got. I mean, why not? Everybody wants to hear, and loops in the others, and they do it, and the guy doesn't actually have anything. His friend, the Russian lawyer, really is there because she wants to lobby on this Magnitsky Act. They don't really care about that. The meeting doesn't last very long. Okay, what harm was done? So no harm, no foul?
Couple of things.
Okay.
Couple of things. One, this was a person who's being represented as representing the Russian government.
Yeah, amped up. Amped up,
fine. But you take the meeting thinking that. You take the meeting thinking also that they're bringing compromising information around Hillary Clinton, and you take the meeting being told this is part of the Russian government's effort to try to influence the election and to help your father's campaign. So all of those things have to happen. Then you have to loop in the campaign manager, the campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, and your brother-in-law, Jared Kushner, and you bring them all in for the meeting.
Can I stop you for a second and just ask you a question?
Yeah.
So if all of that was said in those emails is not true, if this guy is a promoter for a Russian pop star who's trying to get his friend in for a meeting, so he exaggerates everything and none of it is true.
Yeah.
Is there still a problem for Don Jr.?
Potentially, because it still would suggest intent, because he thought that, and he thought that's what he was getting.
Because he was willing to accept help.
Yes, but even granting—
From a charlatan even who didn't really have any help to offer.
True, yes, but let's grant all that. Then you have, there were no meetings between Russians and Trump campaign officials.
Oh.
You have—
You mean the way they— I don't want to say lies.
It's a tough word to get, misled, perhaps.
Weren't exactly accurate.
They were they were clear for months and months and months that this,
Manafort in June.
That's right.
With George.
That's right. And
we've had nothing to do with any Russians.
And Don Jr. at the convention. They called this a charade. Yeah. They called it a witch hunt. The president of the United States continues to call it a witch hunt. And in fact, they had been not truthful. In the case of Jared Kushner, he omitted this meeting from an official government disclosure form. He's had to go back and amend. And so the cover up, if not the crime, ends up being the story.
Interesting. So I want to get to you referred to the kind of legalistic phrasing from the White House. I don't know if I would say legalistic. I don't know if they're trying to be cute here. But I did notice a very specific phrase from Sarah Huckabee Sanders earlier this week when asked about the question of collusion.
Are you vouching just for everyone in total or individuals or what?
I'm saying that the president's campaign did not collude in any way.
So
that's
different people. What do you say about that? Don Jr., anyone, the names that are coming.
I would certainly say Don Jr. did not collude with anybody to influence the election.
What about Flynn?
To my knowledge, he did not collude with anybody to influence the campaign. Again, I think I've been very clear. Our position is that no one within the Trump campaign colluded in order to influence the election.
That's a lot of, words.
It sounds kind of blank.
While wearing
nobody
green pants.
with the intent. What was the...
Influence the campaign. Yeah, that's a lot of careful words there that get appended to what used to be a...
We didn't have any contact with the
Russians. No contact.
We had nothing to do with the Russians.
President Trump said it. No contact, no collusion. Boom,
now,
four
nobody
words.
With the campaign colluded with the Russians to...
Influence
the election. Right. Okay. All right. So one more thing before we get to our discussion with Senator Durbin, also from today's hearing. I thought it was interesting that this is... I mean, can you imagine... You know, having to step in to take the FBI director during this time. So interesting question came from Senator Leahy about whether or not there had been a loyalty pledge. And here's what Ray had to say.
My loyalty is to the Constitution, to the rule of law, and to the mission of the FBI. And no one asked me for any kind of loyalty oath at any point during this process. And I sure as heck didn't offer one.
And, you know, he sure as heck seemed to win over some Democrats in that hearing.
Yeah, and I think the accounting that he had of how he got the job and the meetings he had and the fact that he didn't have that conversation, that neither the president nor anyone else at the White House team or the Justice Department even mentioned this investigation, they seem to have played this one by the books. And it looks like he'll be confirmed and we'll have a new director of the FBI under some of the strangest circumstances imaginable.
And, I mean, I guess you got to kind of give it to the president here. I mean, he picked Guy ultimately. They had a kind of an interesting process of getting there, you know, the Joe Lieberman flirtation and all of that.
Right.
But he managed to pick somebody for this highly contentious, you know, I mean, could there be anything more contentious than replacing Jim Comey, who has, as far as I can tell, won over a heck of a lot of Democrats.
Yeah, going to get a lot more votes than Neil Gorsuch did at the Supreme Court even. And that seemed to go pretty well for them as well. So maybe an attempt to turn down the temperature just a tiny little notch as they look forward for new management under less contentious circumstances.
Hey, this is Dan Harris, and I want to tell you about my podcast called 10% Happier. You can listen every Wednesday for new guests and new perspectives. Some of these are people you know, celebrities, athletes, executives. Some of them are more obscure people that I'm obsessed with that I think you might be obsessed with once you give them a listen. And you can hear about how they're using meditation to up their game in all these interesting areas of life. Again, the podcast is called 10% Happier. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now, and subscribe today.
Now joining us on Powerhouse Politics, Senator Dick Durbin, the senior senator from the great state of Illinois and the number two Democrat in the United States Senate. And Senator, I want to start with the Christopher Wray confirmation hearings, because you were there today and you had a couple of pointed exchanges, including one where you asked him about meetings in the Oval Office, meetings with the president, private meetings. He said that he felt that to be highly unlikely. Were you satisfied that a meeting like that should happen in private? Were you satisfied with that? Is that enough for you? Are you prepared to support this nomination?
Well, I can tell you, I've not reached the point where I'm going to announce my position on this until I think about it a little bit, talk over with my staff, reflect on what he said. But he made a positive impression. Think about what an unusual moment we are in American history when we are talking about a director of the FBI. And the point I tried to make to him, the outgoing director of the FBI, Jim Comey, said, "I don't want to be caught alone in the Oval Office with this president." How about that?
Right.
That's exactly what Comey said. And then Comey started saying, and incidentally, when I walked out of the door of meetings with this president, I wrote it down, you know, a transcript of what I remembered that was said. That has, incidentally, evidentiary value from an FBI agent. And so I tried to bring that to Mr. Ray and said, what are your thoughts on that? Well, he didn't want to answer it directly because it was a pretty hard question. But I know from my conversations privately and what he said publicly here, he is very sensitive to the fact that he needs to maintain his independence.
So one level of that, of course, is avoiding a private interaction. Another level might be recording this. But how do you, assuming he's confirmed, how do you in the Senate, in the Judiciary Committee and elsewhere, how do you police that once he is confirmed as FBI director? Is it just on him to self-police, ultimately, if there is some kind of interference with the White House?
The honest answer is that's exactly what it is. We may call him in to testify about a given investigation, although they're pretty closed-mouthed once they become directors. You know, this investigation's underway, pending litigation, on and on and on. They don't say much. It's rare that we call in an FBI director on something of substance. There may be a budget question or whether they're going to build a new building or something along those lines. But it's rare because, think about it. I mean, his job is not only going after the worst criminals in America, but the terrorists who are threatening America. And you just don't sit down in an open session with a room full of senators under oath and start telling the secrets behind the investigation.
Does he or whoever gets this job, does the FBI director under President Trump have to act differently, at least in terms of that aspect of the job? Do they have to be on guard? Do they have to do the job differently than an FBI director under a previous president might have had to do?
Without question. I can tell you I've been there for Bob Mueller when he was director of the FBI, the renewal of his service, as well as Jim Comey. We never really got into the kinds of questions which Mr. Ray faced today. And they all get down to this. If this president does something else that is outrageous, talks about shutting down an investigation that may get into the White House, calls you a nut job, I mean, what are you going to do about it? I'm pretty solid in the position that Ray is a man of principle. He respects Comey, told Comey at one point way long ago that if you leave the Department of Justice, I'm leaving with you. So I think he's a man of principle, and that is the important starting point. And we're asking those questions because this president has forced us to ask those questions.
So essentially, he's got to be on guard. He's got to be looking differently at every interaction with the White House than another president might have.
He does. I mean, and when Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general now in charge of the Russian investigation, with Mueller, called and asked Ray to take the job, he said to him, "We've got an independent counsel now in Bob Mueller. It's going to create a much better atmosphere for your job with the FBI." That's just, I mean, that is an insight into the state of affairs 6 months into the Trump presidency.
So I want to ask you about the now infamous email exchange from Don Jr. that came out earlier this week. Is that, to your mind, a game changer in terms of the public understanding of this storyline? Does it fill in significant gaps, to your mind, and take this to a different level?
It does. And I will tell you that you have to understand there's been denial from the White House, from the president on down, that there was ever any contact or that anything was done to help the campaign by the Russians. And it turns out these emails tell the whole story. They were looking, the contacts were made, they were looking for help from someone purported to be with the Russian government. Turns out they weren't, but that's the representation that was made. And so in terms of denial, doesn't work anymore. The emails of Donald Trump Jr. himself really tell the story.
And to your mind, what is that story? Is it collusion? Is it treason? What is the story that's told via these emails? Because you can read them on their face and say, well, at least there's the intent here. But is that criminal?
Best spin, a rookie in a political campaign, totally naive. Somebody calls and said, I can give you some dirt on Hillary Clinton. He says, come on down, can't wait to hear it, and doesn't take into consideration this is a Russian government official or supposed to be. Worst case scenario, he knew exactly what he was getting into. I mean, there's a reason why we haven't seen these income tax returns. There are some connections with Russia and the Trump business that I think will ultimately be disclosed, but we don't know today. But there's Donald Trump Jr. using his Russian connections to help his father get elected president. Is it a crime? Well, that's for Bob Mueller, the independent counsel. I hate to pass the buck on it, but I really believe he has to make that decision.
So we saw President Trump tweet in defense of his son a couple of different things. One of them is declaring him to be innocent. Is that we kind of think about his tweets as just, you know, this is part of what he does right now, right? And it's breaking new barriers. But is that influencing the investigation to your mind? I mean, the question of innocence is, as you say, for Mueller to decide. And we've already heard from the White House the possibility that Trump could step in, the president could step in and fire Bob Mueller. Is that just tweet things that don't matter very much, or is that putting your finger on the scale?
Well, I will tell you this. First, I trust Bob Mueller. I hate to do this as a politician because you stick your neck out too far, you can regret it. But when he comes down and makes his pronouncement as to whether or not this is serious and should be pursued by way of prosecution, I'm prepared to stand by him. I trust him that much. I think he really loves this country, and he's not going to play politics with this. Having said that, yes, the president has the power to basically dismiss Bob Mueller or anyone else. And I fear, my greatest fear, that as this gets closer and closer to his family in the White House, he'll be tempted to do it. That could precipitate a constitutional crisis. I hope we don't reach that point.
And your expectation would be, based on the representations today, that Chris Wray would resign if it came to that.
Well, that's the way I feel. I mean, his answers were pretty direct on that, and he was asked that by several different senators, and he was very strong in his response.
I want to ask kind of a broader question, just aside from the partisanship as much as you can, aside from the partisan politics. You've been around Washington a long time. This has been just an intense 6 months or so of the Trump presidency. What is it like just for you personally, waking up every day into the news madness with so many things popping in every direction? Maybe for a senator, this is typical. What crosses your desk maybe is as busy. I'll say from where I sit, I've never seen anything like it. Is it dizzying to you from where you sit?
It is. It's very troubling because for the longest time, for the first 10 or so years I was here, before the arrival of Fox and some of these other things, the news channels and the news sources were pretty well known, who you could trust and who you couldn't. And then things started getting fuzzy. You know, all of a sudden National Enquirer is being quoted seriously by people. And you're wondering, what's happening with news sources and information sources, truth and facts? And now we are in a completely bizarre and surreal world of charges of fake news, sources, phony stories, on and on and on. That troubles me as much as anything. In a democracy, you know, it's good to have differences of opinion and people expressing them. But when you have differences on facts and you can't agree on the basics, it really undermines public discourse, public conversation about the issues. That worries me the most, even beyond this president. That worries me the most about where we're headed. If 40% of Americans get their news on Facebook, 40% on Facebook? You know, yeah. God save us. I read it so I can find out what my kids are talking about. But I don't go to it as a news source. That to me would be pushing it.
Are you just a little window into the conversations you have with your colleagues in the Senate? I mean, are you guys checking Facebook and your Twitter feeds and saying in the cloakrooms, my God, can you believe what's happening? Or have you seen this? Just the torrent of news. I'm sure you have people that can keep you up to speed. It just seems impossible to keep up with.
It is. Well, we've reached a point where we're almost like high school kids here. I try my darndest not to pull out my iPhone, my cell phone. But, you know, you're in a meeting and people are saying, excuse me, did you just hear XYZ happened? And all, I mean, it is constant. And I'm thinking, attention deficit disorder is going to hit hard here for people our age who are bombarded with this late breaking news every 15 minutes. And yes, it has changed the discourse, it's changed the conversation, and it worries me about the ultimate impact it's going to have on our democracy.
So one question on healthcare before we let you go. There's an effort, as you know, to try to get a Republican bill forward. There's the partisan push that's continuing, and there's some amendments that are floating around. Is there any bipartisan action going on behind the scenes? Any rumblings of something that could emerge should this effort from Republicans fail?
The Republicans who are interested in it, and there are some, are waiting because McConnell has said, hold back, give me my chance to pass this bill. If he fails, and I hope he does because it's a terrible bill, I think it's going to unleash conversation and negotiation. And that's long overdue. It'll be bipartisan, and I hope that it's good. I'd love to be part of it, and I trust some of the Republicans I've talked to. They want to do constructive things and make our healthcare system work better. They don't want to destroy it, repeal it, take health insurance away from 22 million people. So, yes, I think that once McConnell has reached a point where he can't pass a bill, there will be such things occurring. But I'll tell you something else. It's rare around here that somebody like Mitch McConnell calls a bill if he doesn't have the votes. He's got $100 billion to play with, literally, giving a wave to members to get their votes. I'd be surprised if he calls this bill and doesn't have the votes.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of it failing on the floor seems far-fetched. You've been in position on the majority side as well. But what are a couple of things off the top of your head that you'd be interested in working on? Reforms to Obamacare, reforms to insurance markets that you think you could get some bipartisan work on?
Prescription drugs. That's the number one issue with the public. It is the hardest issue in the Senate, probably the House too, because pharma has ingratiated itself to Democrats and Republicans alike, and it is hard to take them on. They're making so much money. They're driving up the cost of health insurance premiums with the outrageous cost that they're imposing on consumers across America. But that is number one. If we're serious, that's number one. Number two, as far as I'm concerned, is dealing with this individual insurance market. All of the horror stories that you hear about health insurance under the Affordable Care Act are confined to 6% of the American population that buys them on insurance exchanges. Can we fix this problem? Of course we can. But we've got to roll up our sleeves and say, how do we get an insurance pool that brings premiums down? The third thing I'd say is, no matter where you live in America, there ought to be a public option health insurance plan that you can choose for your family if you wish. That, to me, would be a good way to make certain everyone has an option out there and one that's affordable.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, we appreciate you being here on Powerhouse Politics, and good luck with the Twitter feed and the Facebook feed and the rest going forward. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
So there you have it from Senator Durbin. Possible that a healthcare compromise emerges out of the ashes, and enlightening to me that senators are just as overwhelmed as the rest of us by this news cycle in Donald Trump's Washington. That does it for this edition of Powerhouse Politics. You can follow John on Twitter at John Carl. You can follow me at Rick Klein. You can subscribe to our podcasts. You can find us anywhere these days. Please leave us a rating. Let us know how we're doing. Give us a hashtag at Powerhouse Politics and ask us a question. We'll try to answer it. And please click on us next time.